Indo-European. And that is, if so, they are the first Turkish speakers to appear in Europe. And the arrival of the Turkish speakers across the steppes, that movement from east to west, as we'll discuss in coming lectures, really marks the turning point from the ancient world to the Middle Ages for at least the peoples of the Eurasian steppes. Now, the Huns achieved a great victory over the Goths and took possession of the Pontic-Caspian steppes, just as earlier the Sarmatians had and before them the Scythians. That is the original heartland of those early Indo-European nomads, now fell under the rule of the Huns. In that position, they invariably expanded in two different directions. One was to go immediately to the south, towards the Caucasus Mountains. They met up with the Alans, that Sarmatian people who had plagued the Romans and the Parthians. And the Alans now told the Huns, by the way, there are these things known as the Dariel Pass and the Derbent Pass, and even farther on, there passes through the Elburz Mountain, and we can raid into the Middle East. And there are reports of the late 4th century and early 5th century of Hun invasions across the Caucasus into the Sassanid Empire. And these were particularly destructive. The Huns ransacked Armenia, Mesopotamia, northern Syria. Actually, St. Jerome in Bethlehem at the time, working on his Latin translation of the Bible, the so-called Vulgate, makes report of these horrible invasions on the scale of the Mongols. And he uses the same language that later Christian monks and chroniclers would use of Mongol invasions. And eventually, these Huns withdrew. They were there for raiding, taking plunder and goodies. They refused to face the full Sassanid army, and it left the Sassanid Shahs with a new threat of trying to defend their empire from the northwest, from these Huns across the Caucasus, and that resulted in efforts of cooperation between the Eastern Roman court and the Sassanid Shahs to try to garrison and control those passes over the Caucasus, which becomes an important strategic position through the whole of the Middle Ages, control of those passes, and therefore the movement of nomadic peoples out of southern Russia into either Asia Minor, the heartland of the later Byzantine Empire, or into the lands of the Caliphate, what we would today call Iraq and Iran. So for the Sassanids, this was an unexpected and new nomadic menace, one that they really didn't want to deal with because, as we shall see in an upcoming lecture, they have a lot more problems on their northeastern frontier trying to control Transoxiana from yet new nomads. Meanwhile, the Huns also moved west. They followed routes that the Sarmatians followed. They would naturally be drawn to the grasslands of the Danube. That would be the regions today of the Hungarian Plain and Transylvania. It would also be to the regions of Wallachia, the Wallachian Plains of eastern Romania. All of these are traditional grasslands that nomadic peoples would move from the steppes of southern Russia into central Europe. And again, to some extent, they were occupying areas that had once acknowledged Gothic suzerainty, had once been homes to the Sarmatians, and undoubtedly they intermixed and assimilated nomadic peoples already living there. The appearance of the Huns in what we would call Central Europe, as opposed to the Eastern steppes, posed an interesting problem for the Roman imperial government. These movements began probably around 395. We know of a Hun ruler named Uldun, who ruled approximately from 395 and died sometime after 412 AD. He's seen as an ally of the Emperor of Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Emperor, and the Huns were seen again as useful allies providing federate soldiers. But by the time the Huns arrive in Central Europe, the Roman Empire has divided in two. There is a Western Roman Emperor ruling from the city of Milan. The first one was the Emperor Honorius, who came to the throne at the age of 11, the younger and ineffectual and rather obstinate son of the Emperor Theodosius I, the last emperor to rule over a united empire. And then his elder brother, at age 17, took over the eastern half of the Roman world. That was centered in the city of Constantinople. And the two courts were often at loggerheads over the first half of the 5th century AD. That is because the Western court fell under the control of Generalissimos. Magister Militum was the official title. The first one was a man named Stilicho, who was the Generalissimo, the master of the soldiers of the Western armies from 395 until he was executed for treason in 410. And then later on, the General Aetius, who in the middle of the 5th century AD would dominate the Western court, which at that point had moved to Ravenna in 402. And so you have a Western court under the control of essentially a military strongman, one would even say a warlord, who could command the various Roman armies, at this point largely comprising barbarian mercenaries, and then an Eastern court, where the emperors were just as ineffectual, but were ruled through a civil bureaucratic class that maintained control of the government. And the generals were ultimately supported, were paid, and a subordinate to the civil government, to the imperial court. And generals could be fired and executed rather than lured into suspicious arrangements and murdered, which is what happened to both Stilicho and Aetius. Well, that division of the two courts was very much to the advantage of the Huns. The Eastern court saw the Huns initially as an annoyance and eventually as a major threat, whereas the Western court saw the Huns as really rather useful allies. In fact, so useful that Stilicho and later Aetius, the two essentially military warlords of the Western Empire, loved hiring Huns from the rulers of the Huns as a way of getting excellent mounted soldiers who could keep all the German barbarians in line along the Rhine and Danube and who were now settled within the western provinces of the Roman Empire and provided the main military force. And ironically, the late Roman Empire of the West in the last 75 years of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century, it collapses in 476 or officially ends, it already had collapsed, is essentially a game of the Roman master of the soldiers maintaining control by using Hun mercenaries, Hun allies, to keep his German allies and federates in line. Well, this was an ideal situation for the Huns to exploit. And if it is true that the Xuannu had some kind of connection, the Huns had some kind of connection to the Xuannu, they understood how to play the game, how to exploit a great imperial state in the way that the Sarmatians and the Scythians never did. The kings who follow Uldin, it's hard to know exactly who they are. We hear of a pair of brothers, a man named Rugala or Rua, he has several names, and a brother, Akhtar, who are known to be ruling the Huns, at least the Huns resident in Central Europe in the early 5th century. Their power may have extended over the South Russian steppes. We know that they're in place in the 420s and 430s because the Romans are sending missions up to these fellows, more or less in the vicinity of where Budapest is today. These two brothers apparently shared power and may well have divided power between them in a classic system of lateral succession, which we had seen with other nomadic peoples. But in any event, Rua or Rugala in particular was closely allied with the Western court, especially with that general Aetius. Aetius had made himself master of the Western court in 425. When the first Western Roman Emperor Honorius mercifully died in 423 AD, there was a brief civil war, and Aetius actually backed the usurper, a fellow called Johannes. But the legitimate emperor put on the throne was Valentinian III, the son of Galla Placidia, one of the formidable Roman empresses of the late Roman world. And Aetius pledged his loyalty to him. Aetius had on command from Rugala and Akhtar 60,000 Hun soldiers. That probably meant Huns and Hun allies, and weren't all Huns. But it was clearly the most formidable field army in the Western Roman Empire. And Aetius could bully his way into dominating the imperial court and essentially running the Western provinces under the title of patrician, which was a civil title that gave him control over the taxing and administering of Roman Gaul, as well as his title of masters of the soldiers. And he could call those Huns on cue to attack recalcitrant Germanic tribes. The most famous one was either in 436 or 437, where Rugilla or Rua lent Hun soldiers who ruthlessly destroyed the Burgundian Germans at the city of Worms. And that massacre of the Burgundians lived on in later Germanic legend that fed into the legend of the Niflungs and the Nibelungs, the Nibelunglied in Middle High German, the Niflungs in Norse mythology. It was remembered as a great attack. Furthermore, Aetius made sure to keep on excellent terms. If the Huns raided Roman territory, not a problem. They were allowed to plunder the Balkans. And Aetius was pretty much indifferent to what the Huns did vis-a-vis the Eastern court. Now, the Eastern Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman emperors at Constantinople, had a very different view of these Huns. They were much closer to the locus of Hun power, which was that Pontic Caspian steppes. There's been a lot of learned discussion that when the Huns settled in what is today Hungary, they lost their cavalry edge, because the Hungarian plain cannot sustain the large numbers of horses necessary to maintain steppe cavalry. And there's been several significant articles and monographs written along those lines. Well, that's true, except that whoever was a charismatic leader who could dominate the Hun Confederation could summon many, many Hun forces from the Pontic Caspian steppes, and we believe that's eventually what Attila the Hun did. He may have resided on the Hungarian plain, but his authority ranged widely, probably to the Volga, if not to the Ural River, where he had large numbers of steppe cavalry that he could summon with promises of plunder. And that gets at the crux of the problem. For the Eastern Imperial government, they faced Huns whose raids increasingly became more and more difficult to contain. Initially, the imperial government had been concerned about Goths, who had entered the Roman Empire in 395, eventually would migrate. They would sack Rome en route in 410, which is often taken as a symbolic act of the breakup of Roman power. But the Goths, who had been pushed into the Roman Empire, rebelled and eventually migrated through the Roman Empire to carve out an independent kingdom with Roman blessings in southern Gaul. And that would be the first of a series of Germanic barbarians being accommodated within the Roman Empire. Well, when those Goths moved into the Roman Empire and moved west, that meant the Huns now bordered on the lower and middle Danube, that is, the frontier of the Eastern Roman Empire, and were dangerously close to Constantinople. They raided repeatedly into the Eastern Roman Empire for captives, for gold, for payoffs, because this is a way the Huns would reward their various supporters. And that was quite in the tradition of the Xuan Nu. They would raid the Chinese Empire for silk. The Huns are raiding the Roman Empire for gold. One response was to build the Great Walls of Constantinople. These were ordered by the Empress Ilia of Pulcheria, the older sister of the Emperor Theodosius II, and the walls were built along the four-mile land side of Constantinople. Constantinople is essentially a triangle. On the north is the Golden Horn, the river flowing into the Bosporus. On the other side is the Sea of Marmara, and then it's facing the Bosporus Straits. And you cut off that land side with 4 miles of wall that turned the city into an invincible island. And those walls, which are being rather heavy-handedly restored, but nonetheless restored by the current government in Istanbul, were awesome. There was a huge fosse or trench, 25 feet deep, 50 to 60 feet across, an outer wall with towers, and that outer wall was 25 feet high with towers and fortified gates. There was an inner wall 40 feet high with 60-foot towers. Some 95 of them have been counted. These walls literally sealed off Constantinople from direct attack. So any Hun attack over the Danube into the Balkans would hit those walls and essentially ricochet west. And that is, the government in Constantinople accepted the fact that the Huns would ravage their European provinces, but at least the capital would be preserved, and the Huns could not cross over into Asia Minor. And it was the construction of those walls of Constantinople that turned the new Rome, Constantinople, the capital of the Eastern Empire, into the queen of cities and the bastion of the future Byzantine Empire, which would defy barbarian after barbarian, nomadic tribe after nomadic tribe would fail before those walls. So that was one way of dealing with the Hun threat. The other was to try to pursue a tradition of divide and conquer, that is to play the different Hun rulers off with each other, to pay them bribes of gold and the like. And that worked only so far until a figure managed to unite those tribes, and that was Attila. Up until the appearance of Attila, Eastern diplomatic policies were rather sound, and in some ways corresponded to what the Han did. And the Romans really had no experience of dealing with the great nomadic confederacy. But that would change dramatically with the emergence of Attila, the scourge of God. And he would organize a great nomadic confederacy that bore no resemblance to any nomadic threat the Romans had ever faced, and a nomadic confederacy that could threaten the very existence of the Roman world.
Lecture 12, Attila the Hun, Scourge of God.
In this lecture, I want to finish the history of the Huns, and particularly Attila, the scourge of God, who succeeded to the sole rule over the Huns after apparently orchestrating the murder of his brother during a hunting accident, dated usually around 444-445 AD. Now, in the last lecture, we introduced the Huns as the first Turkic-speaking nomads, or proto-Turkic-speaking nomads, to enter the steppes of southern Russia, that is the Pontic-Caspian steppes, and then moved into the grasslands of central Europe. The exploits of Attila the Hun are really legendary. He's a figure that captured not only the imagination of contemporary authors, we have a number of accounts and even a description of him by a Roman envoy, Priscus, who actually visited Attila, but the image of Attila as the pitiless conqueror, the barbarian of the distant steppes of the East, this has endured for centuries. And it has inspired all sorts of presentations and novels and films and artwork over the centuries. And furthermore, Attila has been admired in many instances. For instance, the later kings of Hungary, known as the Arpad kings of Hungary, themselves nomads. Their real name is Magyars, but we call them Hungarians because Western Europeans in the 9th and 10th century identified them with the Huns, and Hungarian is really a misnomer for these people. But they took it upon themselves to become Huns or Hungarians, since the name of Attila struck such fear in the hearts of Western Europeans. And they even claim to have the sword of Attila. That was a medieval legend that some shepherd had found a sword, had brought it to Attila. It was a promise of universal world domination, sort of a nomadic version of Excalibur and King Arthur. And it passed to, of course, Attila, and then was lost for centuries, but magically found by the Hungarian kings. And this sword is actually on review in the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna. It eventually gets into the hands of the Habsburgs, who essentially marry every ruler in Central Europe you can come up with in the 16th and 17th centuries. So most everything ends up in Vienna one way or the other. In any case, it is indicative of how Attila was viewed. The Ottoman Turks, themselves having no real direct connection to Attila the Hun, admired the steppe conqueror because, as we'll discuss later on in the course, the Ottoman sultans, or the Ottoman sultan caliphs, to be more accurate, in Constantinople, saw themselves as Ghazi warriors, warriors of the steppes. That's a traditional term to designate Turkish warriors in the Muslim period. And therefore, they identified with Attila the Hun and with Genghis Khan. And they very much compare the two. And the names Attila and Genghis are still very popular names in Turkey today. In fact, in 1974, when the Turks intervened in northern Cyprus, they codenamed the operation Operation Attila, or Attila. Usually in Turkish, the name is spelled A-T-I-L-L-A, but it's the same name. In European traditions, especially among the Germanic peoples who were subjects of Attila the Hun, Attila lived on as a great lord. We have descriptions from Roman sources, particularly Priscus and others who had arrived at Attila's court, thought to be somewhere near Budapest, the Roman city of Aquinquim. And the description is that of a great hall that reads like something right out of Beowulf or Norse saga. And Attila was known in Norse legend as Atli, A-T-L-I, a great king. The Norse didn't really know much about Huns, whether they were cavalry people or nomads or anything, but they had the image of Attila as a great king, an avaricious king, somehow responsible for the destruction of the Burgundian family of Gunnar, who is based on that historical Burgundian king wiped out in 436 or 437 by Huns operating as auxiliaries of the Roman master of the soldiers, Aetius. And Attali lives on in Norse legend. He's associated with the Volsungs. He lures Gunnar and his family into a great hall. There's a great battle in which the Burgundians are killed. But the sister, Gudrun, avenges herself by killing Attali because she had been married to him after she had lost her true love, Sigurd. This story is retold in the Nibelungenlied, except Attila there, known as Etzel in German, is a sympathetic figure who is really quite astonished that his wife wants vengeance on her Burgundian kinsman. Whatever version of the story you take, the Icelandic or the Middle High German, Attila rings largely as a great figure. And he appears in romantic paintings of the 19th century, particularly by French painters who were conjuring up images of the destruction of Gaul, of France, by the hordes of the Huns. He is also linked with the great famous meeting of Pope Leo I, of whom we'll speak about later in this lecture. Leo I, who reputedly prevents Attila from attacking Rome. And that dramatic scene was a painting. There was a painting commissioned by Pope Julius II, done by Raphael, in which Julius II is Pope Leo I. It's kind of nice coincidence there of the great Renaissance Pope being linked with that great medieval Pope. In more modern times, there are the pop movies, great films, classical biblical spectacles, as I like to call them, in which Attila is portrayed in a number of movies. He's even been reprised. The role has been reprised for some made-for-TV movies. But still, in my mind, the quintessential Attila the Hun on the big screen is Jack Palance, starring in a little-known and deservedly little-known film known as Sign of the Pagan, with Jeff Chandler playing the Emperor Marcian, and an incredible Rita Gam being the warrior daughter of Attila in the movie. And there's several other renditions of Attila in the movie tradition, but really Jack Palance is the best. He also plays a very credible Ogedai, the third son of Genghis Khan, in a movie called The Mongols, which is loosely based on the Mongol invasion of Europe, which we'll get to later in the course. But all of these images that have come down to us of Attila have resulted because he is the first step conqueror of whom we have a real sense of who he was. And this is because of the nature of the sources. We have some information on Modu Chanyu, but all of the other step conquerors that we've discussed so far, we only have snippets about them and general discussions of these rulers, the mores and the customs of their peoples. Attila, we actually have some information, and he had a profound effect on both the Eastern and Western Roman Empire, and really an important effect in dictating the course of European history, and also announcing what we think is a very, very important ethnic and linguistic transformation, and that is the gradual shifting of the peoples of the steppes from Iranian-speaking languages to Turkish-speaking languages, which marks the beginning of the Middle Ages on the steppes, in my opinion. In any case, Attila and his brother, Bleda, came to the throne jointly in 434, succeeding their uncle, Rua or Rugala, who had had a long-standing alliance with the Western Roman court. The brothers shared power. They may have actually divided the tribes among themselves. We're not sure what the arrangement was, but initially they very much pursued traditional Hun policy, which is attack the East, loot the East, ally with the West, that is the Western Roman Empire. The brothers were more than willing to lend their horse archers and their Hun allies, their Hun vassals, to the armies of Aetius and the Western Roman Emperor. At the same time, they began systematic attacks into the Balkan provinces. And this region was loosely called Illyricum, which would embrace the former Yugoslavia, and Thrace, which is today largely Bulgaria. These provinces came under increasing attack in the 440s. The attacks were designed to extort loot, captives, all sorts of specialists who could manufacture things. It was also hoped that the Eastern Roman court, ruled by the incredibly ineffective Theodosius II, who had a dreadfully long reign from 408 to 450, and his only claim to fame is he was a calligrapher. He didn't even bother to read the law code that bears his name. The walls of Constantinople bear his name, the Theodosian walls. They were really built by his older sister and the prefect Anthemius. He was an incredibly lazy emperor and creature of the court. But he was served by a very able sister, competent generals and ministers who were able to preserve the Eastern Roman Empire against the attacks of Attila. These attacks increased in intensity. And it seems that Attila and his brother Bleda were able to capture large numbers of Roman specialists. And we have stories of this told by that Roman author Priscus, who visited Attila. He gives us marvelous stories how a Roman merchant was captured by the Huns and decided to go Hun. And there's a long conversation between the Roman envoy and this former Roman merchant, and he tells of his virtues. Look, I was married to a Hun wife. I can ride around and fight and pal around with the Huns. I gain wealth and honor, whereas in Rome I'm despised. And it's a very, very suggestive anecdote. You remember our Chinese envoy, Chuan Jian, was also married to a barbarian wife, the Shuang Nu, except he rebelled and wanted to go back to China. But in this case, this Roman merchant went native and joined the Hun elite. We are told of Roman specialists, such as engineers, who build bathhouses for the Huns. And clearly, Attila and Bleda have Roman engineers or Roman-trained engineers who are able to build engines of war, because starting in the 440s, the Huns not only raid, but they're capturing Roman cities. They're able to storm heavily fortified masonry architecture walls of Roman cities in the Balkans, cities such as Wymenacum, Sigdanunum, Siscia, all of the great cities that check and control the Roman road network across the Balkans are now subject to direct Hun attack. Furthermore, Attila and his brother have very, very good information about the going